We'll read the first half of Article 14, entitled The Creation and Fall of Man and His Incapacity to Perform What is Truly Good. We believe that God created man out of the dust of the earth and made and formed him after his own image and likeness, good, righteous and holy, capable in all things to will agreeably to the will of God. But being an honour, he understood it not, neither knew his excellency, but willfully subjected himself to sin, and consequently to death and the curse, giving ear to the words of the devil. For the commandment of life which he had received, he transgressed, and by sin separated himself from God, who was his true life, having corrupted his whole nature, whereby he made himself liable to corporal and spiritual death. And being thus become wicked, perverse and corrupt in all his ways, he hath lost all his excellent gifts which he had received from God, and retained only a few remains thereof, which, however, are sufficient to leave man without excuse. For all the light which is in us is changed into darkness, as the Scriptures teach us, saying, The light shineth in darkness, and the darkness comprehendeth it not, where St. John calls men darkness. To conclude then, our treatment of man and the animals, which we looked at last week, we need finally to ask and answer the question, why did God create animals? Why did God create animals? Why did he bother? Why did God not make a world without animals? What was the point of making animals? And the first broad heading for this is that God created animals and the other things of this world, but now we're focusing on the animals, quote, for the service of mankind. Belgic Confession 12 states that. So how do animals serve us? What do we get from animals?
Food.
We get food. Yep, that was what you said today, wasn't it? Food. That's the first one I put down too. Great minds think alike and fools seldom differ. Yeah.
In the old days, riding horses.
Transport. Riding horses. And there are horses being used for transport. And donkeys. Too. Transport.
Clothing.
I don't believe it. You've actually come up with the first three here. Clothing. Who wore a leather belt in the Bible?
John the Baptist.
John the Baptist. And clothes and camel hair. Trevor?
Working the ground.
Working the ground, yes. Yes. Transport and pulling a plough. Farming, pulling a plough, yep. Anything else?
Security.
Security. Any examples of security in the Bible?
Uh-huh. Must be parking dogs somewhere.
The Bible does say beware of dogs in Philippians 3,
yeah,
that's right.
Something about parking dogs somewhere.
Okay. What about companionship? Yeah, I'd say many of the animals in Northern Ireland, many remarks upon Northern Ireland, the UK in general, very high dog ownership, much higher than most countries. Companionship. Is there reference in the Bible to animals as companions? Nathan's parable to David, when he sought to convince him of the sin of adultery, he talked about a man who had a little lamb and he brought it up and fed it. That was companionship. But it is limited companionship. Your dog is not as good as your wife or your husband. Better be the case. That's what Genesis chapter 2 teaches. And in that connection, we read in Isaiah 11 of children playing with animals. So companionship and games for children with animals. Can you think of any references to in the Bible to animals being used in terms of God's judgment? Sorry?
The Passover, sprinkling of the Passover, something
like that. You're very close.
Mm-hmm.
Stay in Exodus.
All those plagues.
The plagues. Animals involved in the plagues?
Little ones.
Frogs?
Lice?
flies and locusts. Yep, there's four anyway. What about lions? Any instances where God sends lions to judge?
Yes. Go up thy bald head.
Two she bears killed 42 ewes who mocked Elisha. There was a prophet, the foolish prophet in 1 Kings 13 was killed by a lion. And then there were the lions, plural, who attacked the Samaritans. That's a bizarre story in 2 Kings chapter 17. And so the kings of Assyria sent priests back from Assyria to the northern part of the land to teach them the God of the land. So that was where Samaritanism, the Samaritan religion, arose. God also gave animals for the service of mankind so that the animals do messages. Ravens feeding Elijah. A raven and a dove. The ark, Genesis 8. Can you think of a fish that did a message? Jonah's big fish. Yep. And there's another one that had something less big in its mouth. The one that had a coin in its mouth in Matthew 17, verse 27, so that Peter could pay his taxes. And then you have, to leave the Bible examples, you have guide dogs for the blind. And what would you do if you didn't have a guide dog for the blind? That's a pretty amazing thing to give them greater freedom. Can you think of various spiritual lessons which God teaches us through various animals?
Sheep.
Sheep. Yes, we are like sheep. Yep. God teaches us about ourselves from sheep.
The ant
is an example of industry. God takes care of the birds, and they don't sow and they don't reap, but God takes care of them, therefore he'll take care of us. What about Behemoth and Leviathan in the end of Job? If God has the power to make them and they are powerful, how much greater is he than them?
Hens and chicks.
Hens and chicks. Matthew 23, verse 37. The Messiah's gathering of his elect.
The eagle.
Is like that. The eagle.
Going on his wings.
On eagle's wings. Eagle's wings. Okay, so God uses animals to serve mankind. God also uses animals to reveal God himself. That's the teaching of Belgic Confession 2 and Belgic Confession 12. God reveals himself in the creation, those articles teach us, and therefore also in the animals. And God's wisdom, goodness, and justice, and power is seen in the animals too. Animals not only assist and serve man and reveal God in various ways, but God has created animals to serve Jesus Christ, who is the Lion of the tribe of Judah. Any other names for him taken from animals?
Lamb.
The Lamb of God. And indeed, the sacrificial animals, the clean animals in the Old Testament, prefigured his death for our sins on the cross. And if I were to say to you that God also created animals, and specifically one animal, to confound the evolutionists, the duck-billed platypus, as Cain Ham often says. And the duck-billed platypus has the characteristics of a duck, bill, webbed feet. Like a bird, he lays eggs and warms eggs against his body. Like a mammal, he has four legs, a fur hide, a tail like a beaver, and claws or feet like otters. And then, this is one I hadn't realized, he's actually venomous. He is actually venomous. The female platypus isn't, but the male platypus has a spur on its hind foot that delivers a poison which can kill a dog and causes severe pain to human beings. So you don't lift one. True enough, I checked out online and saw a guy holding the platypus. He was holding by his head And then also higher up with his legs, in case he sort of pricked them and jagged one in. The unbelieving evolutionists, though, they do try to categorize him in a certain way, but whether it's convincing or not, I'll leave that to your imagination. Now, we need to see that these studies of various types of beings, these studies help us to understand man. So far in our Belgian confession classes, we have looked at God. What articles dealt with God?
8, 9, 10, 11.
Yes, Belgian Confession 8 through 11 deal with God's three persons. What article in the Belgian Confession deals with God's divine attributes? Belgian Confession 1. And have we had any sermons about God's attributes recently? The ones on God's glorious perfections, dealing with his incommunicable attributes. So whenever we look at God, that always sheds light on man. And we're going to see later today that the incomparable Creator formed man from the dust. So that's man and then God. The more you understand about God, the more you grasp who man is. Similarly, the angels, good and evil, we looked at them when we considered Belgic Confession Article 12. And then we saw how we compare to them in our nature, in our material, how we relate to them too. And then now, not only have we compared man to God and the angels, but we're comparing man to the animals, their similarities and their dissimilarities, at the start of our treatment of Belgic Confession 14. This is how we understand then ourselves. God is our infinite creator. We are a little bit lower than the angels. And men and angels are the only rational, moral creatures God formed. And then we are above and over the animals, having dominion over them. And they are non-rational and non-moral creatures. And these things are very basic, but many people in our world don't know them. The Jains don't grasp these things. The atheists and the evolutionists don't understand them. And so most people don't understand who they are as human beings. But the more you understand God, the more you understand the angels, the more you understand animals, the more we know ourselves by comparing and contrasting. This means that man is not God, and he mustn't act as if he were God. Man is not an angel, nor are our children angels. You say that again?
Yes.
They're not demons either. And they're not little vipers. But they're not angels. No, they're not angels. No. Man is not evolved slime or the highest primate. Man is not a robot or a machine. He's flesh and blood. And there are philosophers who treat man as if he were a machine. Man is not a stock or a block. Sound familiar?
Yes.
Canons of Dort. Man has a will. Man is not what he eats. Man is not matter and motion or a series of chemical reactions. Man is not a number. And he's not a node. Who teaches that man is a node? Who was present at the last BRF conference? Who listened to the speeches online? The moment of truth. The postmodernists. Man is just a node. But the state is all. Man is a rational, moral being, a little lower than the angels, the pinnacle of the creation, created in God's image, to serve the living and triune God. That's man. Man is in honour, as Belgic Confession 14 puts it. Now let's focus on Genesis 2 verse 7. Genesis 2 verse 7. Last time we noted 10 things from Genesis 1 through 2 to indicate that man is so much higher than the animals. Man was created last, as the pinnacle of creation, last but not least. He was created after a divine Trinitarian conversation, created in the image of God, created with dominion over the animals, indeed over all the earth, created to work as an honourable calling, created with the Sabbath, a day's rest, created with marriage, animals don't have these things, created to fellowship with God, and created with a moral test involving the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And now we need to expand upon the truth of man's particularly intimate creation in Genesis 2 verse 7, as we said we would last week. Now, we need to get our numbers straight here. Which of these two statements is better than the other one? Which one is more accurate? Statement number one. Genesis 2 verse 7 speaks of two creative acts. Statement 2. Genesis 2 verse 7 speaks of one creative act with two aspects.
Second one.
Brian, you're putting your neck out. Hopefully it's not a stiff one.
No, God's works are always one.
God's works are always one. That's a good argument too.
I go with Brian.
You're going to agree with Brian, Phil?
Yeah. I think he's called it right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Debbie? Debbie's with Brian as well. Well, you're right. You're right. We are not to think of man's creation as two creative acts, but as one creative act with two aspects. And the one creative act is God's making man, who consists of a body that he formed, into which he breathed the breath of life. And that one creative act with forming the body and breathing into the nostrils results in man's being a living soul. It's not that God formed a clay doll or a clay man and then animates it. It's not like the making of Frankenstein, where you lay him on the bed and then you put the conductor and then you just wait for lightning to strike and then he lives. It's one creative act with two aspects, consisting of forming the body and breathing into his nostrils, so that man becomes a living soul. And then this truth, one creative act with two aspects, fits with the basic truth about man, that man is one, unified in one sense, but having two aspects in another sense.
Not to deviate too much from this pathway, but can you say anything in connection with this in regards to conception? Thinking about the soul.
On the way in, I was saying to Mary that there's a number of things we're not going to cover tonight, and that issue was one of them. But it's good to bring it up now. The issue that Philip has brought up is the issue between creationism and traditionism. So I said, Mary, tonight we're not going to get to this or this or this or the other thing or that thing. And she kind of wondered if we were going to get to it by the end of the Wednesday night Bible study season. And then I said, on the subject of creationism and traditionism, but you just brought up a thought myself, you know, and said there too. I'm not sure we will cover that one at all, because that's a pretty difficult one. But we'll see. But I'm definitely not going to address it now, but I am interested that you thought of that and that maybe you'd like to do it, so maybe we should deal with it. Yeah. So if I were to ask you, are you one or are you two? You could truthfully, in different senses, say either one or two. But if you had to pick one of them, what one would you say?
You want to be one, you want to stay one.
Yes. We are one, you want to be one, and it's very natural to want to stay to be one. Stay one, yep. So man is one, a unified being with two aspects, a body and a soul or spirit. So we need to maintain both of these aspects.
Do not some people think there are three?
on the way in, I also said to Mary, I said, we're going to probably get into dichotomy and trichotomy. Is man two parts or is man three parts? And that's another one. Yep. We'll probably deal with that next week. But for now, we're going to assume dichotomy, and dichotomy is two parts, for want of a better word, and trichotomy, like a tricycle, is three. Okay? So we need to maintain both of these. Can you think of those who make too much of the soul and too little of the body?
Buddhists.
Okay. Care to say a bit more with that one?
Well, they basically just poo-poo all material things. I think, and say that, you know, they all don't matter in the end.
Yeah. They do it if you can. If you can reach nirvana, the more spiritual you are, and the less you eat, and the thinner you are, and the less clothing you put on.
And they deny that suffering exists as well, don't they?
No suffering. It's an illusion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Brahmanism.
Hinduism.
Yeah.
In the ancient world too, we have Greek dualism. We believe there are two aspects, that man is body, man is soul. But they would split the two more, and even more decisively, they would see the body and matter as evil. The body is bad. The Gnostics were of the same mind. Salvation lies in the body, and man in his soul, escaping from the body. Man's soul is a spark of the divine, and then we're temporarily entombed in flesh and blood, but we really want to get out of it, and then we'll be free. The body brings us down. The body is the source of all evil. And there's a form of this too in asceticism in the Roman Catholic Church, for instance, and amongst some fanatics in the early days. If you don't cut your hair or wash your body or trim your nails, you are really, really holy. See, but you don't want to waste time in those sorts of things, because you're so concerned about the soul. And if you can stand on a pillar like the ancient stylites, then you're really holy. I mean, there were Roman emperors who would travel to speak to the holy men who spent all their days up on a pillar, and then would throw them up food and so forth. And the higher the pillar, and the smaller the base, you know, and the longer they could stay up there, the holier they were. So some make too much of the soul and too little of the body, to express in simple terms. Then there are some who deny the soul altogether. There is no spiritual, immaterial aspect side to man at all. What do we call those who believe that position?
Atheists.
Yes, they are atheists. Materialists is even more precise. They say that everything is matter. Evolutionism. I'm reading a book at the moment by an evolutionist. It's mostly historical, and it is very interesting. It's entitled Soul Made Flesh. Soul Made Flesh. And he's dealing with England, especially in the 1640s and 50s, and it's centered around a guy called Thomas Willis in Oxford. William Harvey crops up, and Robert Boyle. Well, they're discovering through opening up cadavers, dead human bodies, how the body works, and they're trying to work out what part does the brain have to play in it all. And from their scientific work, I'm only about halfway through the book, this evolutionary guy says this is a forerunner to evolutionism, whereby now we believe it's all just chemical reactions in the brain. There is no immaterial side of man at all. We're now into evolutionary materialism. John Wood pops up in the book too. It's very interesting, the Civil War and the execution of Charles I and so on. But that's where the evolutionists and the materialists, it's all the brain, chemical reactions. Of course, the problem with that, amongst others, is that there is no such thing as truth. If it's all the brain and chemical reactions in your head, then there's no such thing as morality. You can have a chemical reaction that works or doesn't work, but you can't have truth, you can't have right and wrong. And that's why, too, ethics is particularly under attack, given evolutionism. Now, which of those two is the bigger threat today? You know, denigrating the body or denying the soul?
The most popular one is the latter.
Denying the soul. Certainly in our world, we're not under too much pressure from saffron-robed men with shaved heads. It's the latter, the Western world. Man is just an evolved animal, chemical reactions in the brain. That's the big threat in our day. Now, let's explore this truth that man is a unified being with two aspects. Man's twofold makeup. First of all, man is physical. He's made of the earth. That's our source. Physically, earth. And therefore, being made of the earth, we are related to the earth. Because we're made of the earth, we're related to the earth. And therefore, our thoughts and desires are earthy. Right? So, food, clothing, what's the weather like? Earthy. Our world is earthy. We are earthy. Our thinking and our desires are earthy. So, as well, to underscore that, we take all that for granted without really thinking about it. And it all comes from the fact that we were made of the dust of the earth. Man is earthy. Man is also spiritual. A man is spiritual because God breathed into him the breath of life. And since man is spiritual, he is inescapably related to God. And he can come up with all sorts of evolutionary philosophies and atheistic notions, but he is inescapably related to God, which means that man's thoughts are not only earthy, but they are also concerned with spiritual things. Man may seek to deny this, but he is concerned, he subverts it in 101 and 1001 different ways, he is concerned with his conscience. The difference between right and wrong. And he knows whether God approves of him or disapproves of him. Even man, in his fallen, totally depraved state, is inescapably spiritual in the sense that he's related to God and he knows himself to be related to God. Conscience, right and wrong, ethics, what happens after death, what about marriage, how do I relate to other people? That's man. Because he's made from the dust, and now because God breathed into him the breath of life. And this seventh verse of Genesis 2 is foundational to who man is, and it explains the world of man. Because our origin and source determines our nature. Where we came from, how we began, explains us in our world. Now these two aspects, the physical and the spiritual, the body and the soul, these two aspects of man's makeup, they influence each other. They influence each other. Very much so. Man's thoughts, man's spiritual thoughts, are always, in this world, inescapably earthy. Man's spiritual thoughts are earthy. That's a true statement. How would you illustrate that? What does that mean? Man's spiritual thoughts are earthy. How do you think about heaven?
Suppose you think of it in ways that you would understand from the world around you.
Yep, there's a river in heaven that flows from the throne of God, like the river in the Garden of Eden, and there's a tree in the midst of the river whose leaves are for the healing of the nations. And the streets are made of gold. And it's like a city. It's like a city with walls and great high walls and gates. And there's There are pearls involved in it. Yeah. And the 12 apostles are there.
I can't really think of them.
No, you can't, because we're made of the earth, earthy. So even our most spiritual thoughts are earthy. And so God, when he wants to present heaven, gives us figures in the Bible. He gives us the Garden of Eden. He gives us the land of Canaan. Hebrews 11 makes that clear. That's a picture of the of heaven. He describes it in terms of a garden or a city, Jerusalem, or a country, Canaan, or a place of worship, the temple and the tabernacle.
Even when he describes himself this, he uses terms that, you know, about his body parts and that he doesn't have, but so that we can tell him.
Yeah. God describes himself using anthropomorphisms. His hand and his arms and his ears and his eyes.
And anthropopathisms.
And anthropopathisms. Yeah. There's a new one for you. Yeah, it's a big one too. Yeah, that's man's emotions. So that God says he's angry or he's jealous. But you have to take from that any imperfection. Yeah. So when we think about God, let's say we think about God's eternity, well, we think that means that God existed before the world. We can understand the world at the beginning. So God existed without beginning and without end. And then we think what time is, and then we say God exists without succession. There's no passion in the being of God. And then we reach we hit the wall. And if we say that God is omnipresent, we think of the world, say God fills it all, and he's with me when I sit down and rise up. But then he fills the whole universe. And then we say, well, what's beyond the universe? Who knows? Can you even use a word like beyond? And then God fills himself. Yeah. And then Jesus, when he taught, he used parables. He talked, so he's going to explain the kingdom of God. And he said, a sower went forth to sow. And he said, a fisherman went out and he dragged in a net. And there's a man, he found a pearl in the field. Because we're of the earth. So man's spiritual thoughts are earthy. And if we turn it around, even when involved in earthy things, man ought to be spiritual, moral, ethical, in the sight of God. There's one text which especially sums this up. Whether therefore ye eat or drink, or whatsoever ye do, do all to the glory of God. And you can't get much more physical and earthy than eating and drinking. And there's a biblical doctrine that's involved in this, that even when we're involved in earthy things, we ought to be spiritual. The biblical doctrine, framed particularly by Luther, the priesthood of all believers, that every believer is a priest, whatever his job is. And flowing from that, the Christian conception, Calvin spoke more about this, of calling. Calling. So if you're a housewife, you have a spiritual calling. If you're a bin collector, that's a spiritual calling. It's not at all dishonorable. If you're a schoolboy, you do it to the glory of God, all your earthly things. You can wash potatoes and scrub the floor and cut hair and drive a bus. Spiritually, yeah, that's the Protestant conception. That's why we don't. That's why Protestantism doesn't have monks. Protestantism says it'd be relatively easy for you to be a monk if there were such a thing as a Protestant monk. Protestantism says now you be a Christian and behave spiritually as a husband or a father or a wife or a mother or a taxi driver or whatever your job is in your place and calling in the world. So whenever we think spiritually, our thoughts are earthy, and whenever we're doing earthy things, we must be spiritual, because we're both body and soul in one. And then, man's body affects his soul. man's body affects his soul. How would you prove that? What sort of examples could you give?
People that are alcoholic are miserable.
Okay. Okay. Drunkenness and misery.
Sickness.
And when people are sick in their body, they are perhaps especially prone to doubts and temptations, although God can often make us stronger through sickness, because then we have more time to think. When you're sick, sometimes that's almost all you can do. Although if you're really sick and you're sleeping all the time, you can't do much thinking. But yeah, sickness. Any other proofs that the body affects the soul?
You know, the feeling of marriage, that affects you. You're not just thinking of yourself anymore. There's another person, another thing that has a good effect upon this first thing. Hopefully for the good.
Right. Although, if you really want to suffer spiritually, get yourself into a bad marriage and your spiritual welfare will just plummet. Yeah. Marriage is the making of many a man, it's the ruining of other men. Yeah. And same too with women, Mary. Sometimes they can be ruined by it as well. So any other ways in which the body affects the soul for good or ill?
Depression.
Depression, uh-huh. So depression, a spiritual condition in terms of, you know, man's psychical well-being. A spiritual condition can be brought on by physical things like illness or childbirth.
It's maybe an extreme example, but somebody who commits suicide, they're killing the body, and a lot of people say they're condemning the soul to everlasting destruction.
That's right. Suicide. The soul is affecting the body. Yeah. Eating disorders. Let me see, which way, eating disorders. So the person, which comes first, the spiritual problem or the body? The spiritual problem? The person gets depressed or wants to...
They're on view of themselves.
Yeah, eating disorders.
The ultimate sexual sin in Proverbs, you know, going to those women end up in hell. And also, you know, sinning against the body in Corinthians, same thing.
Yep. Yep, so sexual sins, so lust, more the soul affecting the body. Yeah. What about a bang in the head? Bang in the head. The brain definitely has something to do with thinking, like, and you can even say there are certain parts of it that can deal with certain parts. No, I don't think that. I think that's proved. I don't think that militates against anything in the Bible at all. So, if you get a bite, you can't think as clearly. If you're hungry and tired, physical things, you're prone to get more irritable. Your children too, Philip. Yeah. Fasting, on the other hand, a bodily thing, can help you concentrate better and can help you spiritually. You know, 80 years older, if you have a medical complaint, we wouldn't recommend it. No, I think that's the case. Now, the next one. How does man's soul affect his body?
As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can your soul affect your body adversely? Or can it affect it for good? Let's take somebody who's had a very critical accident, let's say. The doctors will say sometimes that if the person wills to live, how do you measure these things like? But he can pull through. You know, he has something to live for. He knows that his wife and kids will say need him. Or if, we'll say, you have an old man and he's not well and his wife died a few weeks ago, he sort of loses the will to live and he doesn't really fight as much. I think there's something to that. You can also say this, if you're spiritually prosperous, you can cope better with ailments. You know, you don't get down as much, and you can see God's hand on it, and you can keep your pecker up. So,
if you're not doing well spiritually, that small sniffle, which ordinarily wouldn't have kept you from church to the house, but it all of a sudden does.
Oh, dead right. Yep. Oh, can I? Yep. And Hypochondriac. Psychosomatic illnesses. Yep. And psycho, it's interesting, that word psychosomatic, psycho doesn't just mean somebody who's, you know, nuts. The psycho has to do with the soul, and somatic comes from another Greek word meaning the body. It's a soul-body illness. Okay, let's focus again on Genesis 2, verse 7. Now, the first part of that verse says that the Lord formed man of the dust of the ground. That statement portrays God in a certain role. What role? I mean, it doesn't present God as a plumber or as a dentist. It presents God as a builder, even more precisely.
Creator.
More precise than either of those.
Artist.
Artist, yeah, yeah. But even more precise than that. What do you call somebody who makes something out of a potter? A potter. Genesis 2, verse 7. All those other things are true, by the way. Or at least most of them, anyway. But a potter is probably... So God is a shepherd in the Bible, and he's a warrior, and he's a father. Genesis 2:21 portrays him as an anaesthetist of sorts. Puts Adam to sleep, so he removes a rib from him. But he's also a potter, as an honourable calling. The first potter is God. Now, this image of God as potter from Genesis 2 verse 7 is picked up and developed and used later in the Bible. Therefore, all these references to God as potter harken back to Genesis 2 verse 7 and God's making man. Let's look at these verses. We've got several in mind here. First of all, Isaiah 64 verse 8. Isaiah 64 verse 8. We had some sermons on this a while back. But now, O Lord, thou art our Father. We are the clay, and thou our potter. We are all the work of thy hand. And that verse, in its context, refers to God's sovereignty over the church. And the sovereignty over the church, just as the potter is sovereign over the clay, just as God is sovereign over the clay that he formed, out of which he formed Adam in Genesis 2 verse 7. And it's God's sovereignty over the church so that he is able to stir up the church again so that she seeks his face. Isaiah 64 verse 7. Nobody calls upon thy name, O God. Nobody stirs up himself to take hold of thee. God, you've hid your face from us. You've consumed us. But now, Lord, you're the potter. Change and mould us again sovereignly so that we seek thy face. And that's what it takes.
Sometimes Pastor Arminius would refer to us Calvinists as being those who believe in believing what we believe, that it makes man like a robot. But we really ought to say that, no, you think too highly of man, we're just clay pots.
Clay pots, yeah.
We're not even robots.
Yeah. And that's an important truth. Man is a clay pot. Yeah. He's more than a clay pot in there are other senses. But he is, well, a clay pot. And that's what Scripture says. Jeremiah 8 verse 6, here's another similar passage. Jeremiah 18 verse 6, Jeremiah is told by God to go to the potter's house. And it's not a reference to the metropolitan in Belfast. Go to the potter's house, and then he sees a potter working on the wheels. Verse 6 says, O house of Israel, cannot I do with you as this potter? Saith the Lord, behold, as the clay is in the potter's hand, so are ye in my hand, O house of Israel. And the idea especially there is God's sovereignty over the church, that he is able to make it well again. Because the verse 4, the clay was marred in his hand, it wasn't, and then the potter was able to screw it up again, flop it down, and make a good pot out of it. And then if you turn to Isaiah 45 verse 9, potter, clay, Isaiah 45 verse 9, Woe unto him that striveth with his maker, that the potsherd strive with the potsherds of the earth, and a potsherd is a piece of broken pottery. Shall the clay say to him that fasheneth it, what makest thou, or thy work? He hath no hands. And this verse tells us that we must not strive with God about his dealings with us or the church. God's the potter and we're the clay, and you don't speak back if you're clay or a mere potsherd to the potter. And now there's one particularly famous reference to God as the potter and us as the clay. Romans 9, 20, 21, 22, 23. It's quite a developed passage on this. Nay, but O man, Romans 9 verse 20, who art thou that repliest against God? Shall the thing formed say to him that formed it, why hast thou made me thus? Hath not the potter power over the clay of the same lump to make one vessel unto honour and another unto dishonour? What if God, willing to show his wrath and to make his power known, endured with much long suffering the vessels of wrath formed out of clay by God the sovereign potter, fitted to destruction, that he may make known the riches of his glory on the vessels of mercy that he has formed out of clay, to pour the mercy into it which he had afore prepared unto glory? So there's no striving with God about his dealings with the church, Isaiah 45, and there's no striving with God either about reprobation and election, because he's the potter and we're the clay. And this relationship to God as our potter is primary in human existence. Temporarily, it is first. It goes back to man's very creation, before which temporarily there was no man. In fact, it goes back to the very first aspect of man's creation. You could say that God was our potter sort of even before he was our shepherd or our king, in a sense, because that's the first thing he did. He formed us out of the dust. Genesis 2 verse 7 begins, and the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground as a potter. And if you get this straight, then you can grasp and submit to God's sovereignty over the church, for good or for ill, as it seems to us, and God's sovereignty over individuals, for good or ill, as it would appear to our eyes, God's sovereignty in election, and God's sovereignty in reprobation. When you have it straight, you say in effect to God, thou art the potter, and we are the clay. But if you don't grasp this, then you're always going to be striving with your maker, and God says, well look, you're just this piece of broken pottery. Let the potsherds strive with the other potsherds, but don't come bickering and complaining to me. I'm your creator. Do what you're told. Secondly, we'll cover this more quickly. Take the other half, the God is potter, which means that the human race started life as clay or dust or earth. The human race began as clay or dust or earth, which was shaped and molded by God's loving hand, into which he breathed the breath of life. Clay, not slime, never mind monkeys or apes. And this truth too is picked up in the Bible. First of all, what did God call the first man? What name did he give him?
Adam.
And Adam means earth. Secondly, after the fall, God said that man would die. And what is death, according to Genesis 3, verse 19? It is, thou wilt return unto the ground, for out of it wast thou taken, for dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return. And is there a book? Yes. What is it? The book out of the 66 that most speaks of man as clay or dust or earth. Think now, out of the 66 books, it's a hard question, but once you hear the answer, it's one of those ones you think, ah, I suppose it had to be that. The book in the Bible that most refers to man in terms of his being clay or dust or earth.
That was Psalms or Ecclesiastes.
Those are two good answers. My guess is that they could well be numbers 2 and 3. Job. Why does Job speak about man so much as clay? Because it's a book about human frailty and suffering. We're all... Job keeps saying, in effect, I'm just clay. And look at my body. Look at all the afflictions that I'm suffering. I'm just clay. So he talks about man in that way because he is suffering suffering terribly. And then secondly, it's a very early book. Job lived, most think, around the time of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob. So there wasn't much canon of scripture in those days. And it wasn't that long after creation, relatively speaking. It's a very early book. He is mindful that he is made of clay. And whenever you're sick, you think to yourself about your body, and you think, you know, whenever you're up and running, and, you know, and whenever you're sick, you realize that you're just dust. And then a couple more passages. Man being clay comes up whenever we think on terms of our lowliness before God, when we're humble in prayer. Abraham says that he has taken upon him to pray for the elect in Sodom, who is but dust and ashes. And there he was standing before Christ in Old Testament form, and he realized, who is he to be asking any God? He's just made of dust. And then finally, 2 Corinthians 4 verse 7 refers to clay. 2 Corinthians 4 verse 7. I wonder if anybody can think what the clay reference to, or the dust, or the earth reference is to here, before you get to the verse. But it'll take the answer once you get to it too. What does it refer to? Yep, and what's that referring to?
Hey.
Yep, and who's that referring to?
Us.
No, no, it's not. No.
We have the treasure in earthen vessels.
Uh-huh. Yep. Yep. Preachers. That's what it's referring to. We have this treasure, this glorious gospel that causes light to shine in people's heart, which is analogous to the light shining out of darkness on the first day of creation. We have this vast treasure, and we, the apostolic band, the preachers, have it in earthen vessels. Very weak, very frail, easily broken. And that's what the minister is. He's just flesh and blood like everybody else. Yeah. But we're a bit over time. Any comments that can't wait?